I'm wondering if you're wondering, when I said, you know what, I want to interview in Mortal Technique, people kind of looked at me like, wait, what? Why?
Violent lunatic.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a portrait of rapper Immortal Technique. So, why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is Felipe Coronel. A lot of people know me as Immortal Technique.
Immortal Technique, stuck in your thoughts, darkening dreams. No one's as good as me. They just got better marketing schemes.
Born in Peru as Felipe Coronel, Immortal Technique is a legendary underground hip-hop artist known for his skills on the mic, as well as for his raw, super political lyrics.
Is sponsored by corporations. That's why Halliburton gets paid to rebuild nations. Tell me the truth. I don't scare into paralysis. I know the CIA saw Bin Laden on dialysis in 98 when he was top 10 for the FBI. Government ties is really why the government lies. Read it yourself.
His family immigrated to Harlem, New York, from Peru when he was just a toddler to escape the armed conflict there. He grew up in Harlem during the 80s and 90s, at a time when New York City was notoriously rough.
Check the check, constant struggle to make the payments. Working your whole life wondering where the day went. The subway stays packed like a multicultural slave ship. It's rush hour, 2:30 to 8, non-stopping. And people coming home after corporate sharecropping.
Felipe says that because of the way that he grew up, he harbored a lot of rage. And eventually, that rage led him to prison. He was incarcerated for a year during his college years for assault-related offenses. While he was in prison, he honed his rapping skills. And when he was paroled in 1999, he took up freestyle rap battling. And he became a champion in the underground New York City battling scene. Just 2 years later, he released his first album, Revolutionary Volume 1, which launched him to fame, eventually collaborating with famous artists such as Dead Prez, Mos Def, and Chuck D of Public Enemy. But his brutal song, Dance with the Devil, is what he mostly became known for.
He started hanging out, selling bags in the projects, checking the young chicks, looking for hit and run projects.
Today, Immortal Technique spends his time working on philanthropic causes, though he's still writing music, and his fans are holding their breath for the release of his first album in over 10 years. I sat down with Immortal Technique to hear about his life and how his rage got him to where he is today. Just a heads up, in this interview, there will be some discussions about rape and sexual violence. So, Felipe, you were born in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
Where in Peru?
I was born in the Hospital Militar de Lima.
And what area of Lima?
I lived in a place called San Martin de Porres. I have a house there now. It's very much like Harlem in the sense that it was, you know, a dilapidated neighborhood for years, even though it has its originations in a very, very upscale area, right? 50, 80 years ago, and then it turned into a slum. And it's funny because, you know, my father, who grew up in Peru, who thought he would live his whole life there, experienced, you know, 5,000% inflation in a year, a virtual civil war between, you know, Maoist guerrillas and a CIA-backed paramilitaries. And in order to find peace and quiet, he moved to Harlem in the 1980s. And that's the life I began to live.
I'm on the border of Bolivia, working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty, dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete.
As a youth, I would go back there whenever my parents, we wouldn't buy like fancy things. You know what I mean? We didn't have the newest toys or something like that. If we got them, we got them off secondhand. And my clothes all came from a church. Everything that we had was saving up to go home to see my family and to make sure that we maintain that cultural connection, because I think it was very important for my parents to make me understand what it meant to be here and to have those opportunities. It definitely was an eye-opener in the sense that it exposed poverty to me in a way I had never seen it. In America, you live with the illusion of a safety net, right? The illusion of the safety net. You're going to have Medicare. You got Social Security. All these things are going to take care of you. And I think out in Peru, it was more like you're swimming in the ocean alone, and you realize that you're swimming in the ocean alone.
At what point did you, as Felipe, as a young person, did you begin to kind of process, well, there's this reality, but then there's the illusion? because so much of your work as an artist, as a musician, is about kind of pulling back the cover.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the world itself, I think my father was one of the first best teachers I had. Like, he was recruited out of the Peruvian military to be at Columbia University. But it wasn't until I started actually studying human beings that I came to certain realizations about the society that we live in. It wasn't an epiphany that I came to these realizations. I think it was more of a slow burn of realizing that they were just one other layer, one other thing. You know, I'm a person who's visibly Latino, but, you know, my mom's father is Black originally. His family's from the Caribbean. So I grew up with a very, very different idea of African, indigenous, Latino relations. You know, in many ways, I witnessed a lot of people, both especially Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, that I grew up with, friends of mine, that were in total denial of their African ancestry. And I'm looking at them and I'm like, dude, you're blacker than pepper. And you're talking about how you're not Black. You're calling people Prieto and all these other names. And you're talking about your mom. You know that, right?
Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the Black and Indian women, creating Latinos.
Your parents had a lot of hopes, maybe about the illusion of the United States. You're actually going to, at that time, you're going to one of the best public schools in New York City.
Mm-hmm. That's the reason my parents stayed in this city. They were originally going to move to Canada for the free healthcare. And I was living in Harlem and I got into Hunter.
So when you say Hunter, that's Hunter College High School, which is this public school in New York City. It's very high performing. You can test into it. So you have to be super bright to get in. And speaking of Hunter College High School, we've got to bring up somebody who has also been on Latino USA a couple of times, Lin-Manuel Miranda. You know, the accusation is that you were actually a bully to Lin-Manuel, that you, he says you terrorized kids and that you even threw him in a trash can.
Well, his rapper name is Immortal Technique. Uh-huh. He's one of the most sort of politically ideological, he really made sort of an incredible life for himself as a rapper.
Right.
He was a school bully. And he terrorized kids. He'd throw them in the garbage. I got thrown in the garbage by him.
Isn't that interesting?
And, yeah, he was a really angry kid. And
how are you and Lin-Manuel? How is that?
No, we talked, and he was like, yo, I'm sorry about the way the story came out. I didn't mean to say that you were like the most wicked person in the world. And obviously, you know, you changed as an individual since then. And we were a bit on good terms. You know, I've never had like an outstanding issue because of that particular interview. It was more about what other people had brought into the conversation, because to be honest, he wasn't the only one that got thrown in the trash can. There were dozens of people thrown in the trash can. I was a definite violent person. And I think that the contrast came because I was expected to be a certain way at school. And then when I left school, a lot of the kids from school didn't have to deal with the same repercussions and same issues that I had to.
It's like Cambodia, the killing fields uptown. We live in distress and hang the flag upside down. The sound of conservative politicians on television. People in the hood are blind, so they tell us to listen. They vote for us to go to war instantly. But none of their kids serve in the infantry. The odds are stacked against us like a casino. Think about it, most of the army is Black and Latino.
The rage and anger that I experienced as a kid was from living in that dual life. You know what I mean? From going to a good school with a bunch of people who, you know, maybe sometimes would have a shitty attitude problem, and then me going home to Harlem, which was just totally different. Like with Harlem, I remind people in 1988, 87.
It was tough.
I mean, my brother Southpaw and me came home one day, and a dude, no lie, in front of my building down on the street corner, knocked his air conditioner out and it hit a lady in the head, and he pulled out a rifle and just started firing at people. I never discussed these things. Other kids maybe had therapy to talk about this. I didn't have no therapy. So maybe a lot of the things that I had seen and witnessed really kind of change stuff. Like a lot of kids, sure, you lived in New York, but you didn't see the same things that I saw.
So at one time you were asked about the bullying and the violence, and you said, quote, I guess at 17, it was hard for me to see that the person I was really fighting was myself.
I chose violence to be that tool of deconstructing other people's issues. And it led to creating more issues to myself. So every time someone thought, just because he's smart, he's soft, I reminded them every day that I would hurt them in some way. Like, everything about me was structured to fight with people. To be honest, while I imagined that I liked that at the time, really inside of me, I didn't like that. It wasn't something that I enjoyed. It was something that I saw as a necessity. It's touch and go. It's not like I was just a purely wicked kid.
So the rage actually lands you in prison. Is it in prison where you basically decide that that's where you want to move into rap? Or how is it that you decide rap is the place where you're going to find your expression?
I think one of the things about prison isn't that it decided to make me choose rap as a career. I chose rap in prison as a form of meditation, as a form of finding peace. I was thrown in the hole one time. For people who don't know what that is, that's solitary confinement, where you basically live in and exist in a very dark space. Native American cat named Judge, he came by my cell and he shoved a piece of paper and like a half broken pencil in the cell. And he was like, "Yo, man, don't go crazy in there." And I really, man, you know, if there's a person out there who I owe, you know what I mean, to pay their rent, it's definitely Judge, because, man, that piece of paper was covered with so many writing. It looked like I only had one piece of paper to write on. So it was like I wrote on all the lines, then I wrote on the sides, then I wrote on the other sides, I wrote on the back, I wrote on the outside lines. This thing was like the Holy Grail.
So if I should ever fall and get caught in a hustle, let them know that I died while I fought in the struggle. From the hood rats to rich kids lost in a bubble, spray painted on the streets and in the subway tunnels. I used to wonder, I used to wonder.
Coming up on Latino USA, we talk about Immortal Technique's first album and the song that launched his career. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Stacia Shepherd thought she knew her dad. But then one day, a stranger called their home.
The phone is in my ear, and he's saying, "Your father's a crook. Did you know that?"
The story of a fallen hero and the mysterious obsession that drove him for decades, this week on Hidden Brain.
Hey, we're back. And when we left off, Immortal Technique was telling us about how he got into rap. We're going to pick up now with his first album and the infamous song, Dance with the Devil. Just a heads up, in this section of the conversation, we're going to be talking about rape and sexual violence. You released Revolutionary Volume 1, that was your first album, in 2001. And on that album is basically the song that launched your career, Dance with the Devil.
Whew,
which
yeah.
I was listening to it this morning in preparation again.
Jesus Christ.
Just, yeah, no, and I'm sitting here like, whew.
They drove around the project slow while it was raining, smoking blunts, drinking and joking for entertainment, until they saw a woman on the street walking alone, 3 in the morning, coming back from work on the way home. And so they quietly got out the car and followed her, walking through the projects. The darkness swallowed her. They wrapped a shirt around their head and knocked her onto the floor. This is it, kid.
Now what was it about Dance with the Devil that you think launched your career, essentially?
I could give you a million different answers, but I'm going to give you the ugliest one. Everybody either knows someone or has been sexually assaulted themselves. And I think the song came at a time when people were trying to kind of weed through a new generation of hip hop during the 2000 era and looking for who had kind of substance in the music. We never had a song about rape ever in hip hop. Ever. We've probably discussed that. It's been thrown around, but a song in which we showed how that really means you're raping yourself, you're destroying yourself. And then the underlying themes of it, sister, which are that all human beings that are alive right now have to be related. And I wanted that point to resonate in the people's minds when they were out there listening to that music.
I'm falling and I can't turn back.
Right before he pulled the and ended a life, he thought about the cocaine with the platinum and ice. And he felt strong standing along with his new brothers, cocked the to a head and pulled back the shirt cover. But what he saw made him start to cringe and stutter, because he was staring into the eyes of his own mother. She looked back.
The benchmark of Western society that people base all of European civilization on, monarchies, is Rome. And when you look at Rome as a society, you say, where did Rome begin? We see that the beginning of Roman society begins with an act called the Rape of the Sabines. And I think that's a part of all of our genetic memory. I think every single human being who's living right now is a product of rape at some particular point, and they've just never dealt with that. The trauma exists within them as a genetic memory. Some of them have that in their bloodstream more recent than others. When you look at it, it's incredibly humbling as a man to realize that I stand upon the achievements of murderers and rapists to claim the position of power that I have in this society.
It's a little thug's flow. He could be standing right next to you and you wouldn't know. The devil grows inside the hearts of the selfish and wicked. White, brown, yellow, and black color is not restricted.
What comes up for you as you're processing that song?
I mean, it's a difficult thing to talk about, only because there are women in my family and people I've known my whole life that have been survivors of rape. And, you know, obviously it's not my choice whether I share their story. It's not my place without their permission. But I felt like I wanted to draw some idea towards the disgusting nature of what it is and how it actually has a huge place in our human society.
It's really tough to hear that. And so when I've been able to listen to, for example, your love song, You Never Know.
People like you, instead I took a route to the Apollo and the Bronx Zoo, Museo del Barrio and the Metro.
Which I just love because, you know, you talk about taking your love, whether to the Metropolitan Museum of Art or to Museo del Barrio. You know, and seriously, just hearing that in a rap song that's a love song, that's a side of you. You know, the gentle kind of romantic side.
There is a romantic side, yeah. I remember I've written a lot of interesting tweets. I think one of the ones that went the most viral is, I don't know how many thousands it had, but I wrote something and I said, you know, if I really like her, I might buy her flowers. I said, but if I love her, I'll write her a story. After all, what good are flowers when you can create a universe just for her? Writing brought me out of misery and pain, you know? Like a lot of Volume 1 that you hear is a lot of rage and anger, but that's anger and rage that's taken out of me. You know, sometimes if I really love somebody, I would write something for them, something that would help them heal, something that would put their problems, whatever it is that I know about them, into the proper perspective.
Little credit card scam and jewelry stealing, crack selling, liquor store robbing.
It's a rich man's world.
So in 2011, you released Rich Man's World. You know, in a lot of ways, it feels like you were kind of expecting a Donald Trump to appear on the scene before a lot of other people were.
I mean, I put out a lot of messages in the music. Some people at first accused me of being a conspiracy theorist. But here's an interesting thing. What were my big conspiracies on Revolutionary Volume 2? That the Iraq War was based off lies. I then brought up that the government was listening to all your emails and tapping your phone. And people said, that's absurd technique. You live in 1984. That's never going to happen. And look what happened. So the idea that a demagogue, a caudillo, would come in isn't something that is part of the radical imagination of someone who lives in the never-ending story. It's something that was eventually going to happen here in the United States.
Because they don't want my dirty laundry aired when I fight it. Don't get my lawyers excited, because what good is the law if you can't rewrite it? I got CIA traitors, dictators, so y'all whistleblowers and haters. I'll invest money from
a lot of Latinos and Latinas, immigrants, are waking up and they're feeling powerless angry, filled with rage, confused, sometimes hopeless. How are you translating those emotions into your art right now?
One of the things I started doing is I started working with various human rights organizations. That's something that has always given me a really grounded sense of peace. One of them, of course, was the Border Angels, the people that leave water drops and food drops for those people walking through the desert. And the other was a group that I feel doesn't receive enough attention as well. It's called the Green Card Veterans. And these are people who, some of them served in multiple theaters of war. I think people need to realize a lot of these individuals have been deported or are fighting deportation.
Is there any of your writings recently that you can share with us about those issues, about the Green?
Yeah, there's actually a song I have. I can't spit it right now because I know my producer, listen to me, we've kept this under wraps so hard.
One line?
No. Well, God bless
you. One line?
You're a great hustler. I love you. You got a good hustle. No, I think that what we're talking about is a song that describes the, we touched on it earlier, the depression and the suicide of people who have gone to war. And part of that was talking about this particular issue.
So what is Immortal Technique processing now as a musician, as an American? Where is it coming together for you? My son, of course, who was your biggest fan, was like, how come he hasn't written?
No. I've written plenty of stuff. I haven't released it. And there's a lot of reasons for that.
Okay, so the question of your many, many, many fans, you
yeah.
know that. The question
Everybody,
is...
My dad, my mom.
Your dad, your mom, me, we want to know. When's the next text song that we can...
Okay, I actually do have a couple of features coming out, which are just songs that I'm on for other people's projects. And then in terms of the record that I have, I'm closer than I've ever been.
And we're looking forward to hearing it too. Thank you so much, Immortal Technique. Felipe Coronel, thank you so much for all of your work.
Thank you very much for having me here. The Middle Passage coming soon. SP in the building, my dude Mecca, Harlem, Brooklyn. You already know.
Harlem in the house. Immortal Technique just wrapped up touring the U.S., and he plans to release his next album sometime this year. This episode was produced by Maggie Freeling and edited by Marlon Bishop. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. We're edited by Sofia Paliza-Carr and Fernanda Chavari, with additional editing by Allison McAdam. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, be sure to stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. And, dear listener, just one more thing. Can you go to Apple Podcasts and take a moment to rate and review Latino USA? You know, this really helps new listeners to find us, and we know you want to help us do that. Also, we truly love reading all of your comments, so keep them coming. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode, and in the meantime, we'll see you on social media. Ciao!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
We could go on for a while, but...
Wherever.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next week on Latino USA, a conversation with Maria Perez Brown, the creator of the cult Nickelodeon show Taina. We talk about the show's legacy and the love of nostalgic television. That's next week on Latino USA.
Would you put on a sweater that once belonged to Hitler? Can Chinese zodiac signs predict who's going to be a great scientist? And what happens when you use a training method for dogs to teach doctors? Answers to all those questions on my podcast, Hidden Brain.